Thank you so much for the welcome today and the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here in Ecuador. I have slides, but I don't know how to show them to you. And I'm hopeful that the battery in my computer will last. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. So. Oh, that's not the right one. Uh-oh. There we go. So, we'll work without the slides for now. And hopefully I can explain things well. Oh, I'm going to take a picture of you first. Anyone who does not want to be on my website, hide your face. There, now you're immortalized in history. All right. So the title of my talk today is Technology, Diversity, and Human Connection. And you probably recognize that as the theme of the conference, and that's something I like to do, is to draw from the theme of the conference to put my own thoughts and opinions into perspective, into context. So I'm going to talk in four parts. First of all, I'll introduce and provide a quick overview of connectivism, which some of you may have heard of. It's the theory that I'm reasonably well known for and that I think is right. No, just then I'll address each of the terms technology, diversity, and human connection in turn. Sorry, you can tell I'm a technologist because I'm fussing with the technology. Yeah, okay. Grow up, Stephen. Okay. I have to make the text big enough to read for my old eyes. Okay, connectivism. Just curious, how many of you have heard of connectivism? A few. Almost nobody. Okay. Connectivism is a theory about knowledge and learning. And it says, basically, that knowledge is distributed across a network of connections. Yeah.
Sorry.
It's okay. Yeah. There we go. Is that better? I can still make it hum if you want. So, knowledge is distributed across a network of connections, and therefore learning consists of the ability to create those connections and to work across them. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, here's a fact. The fact is, I am standing here in front of you. You all agree? Okay. Now, what's interesting is, each one of you sees me from a slightly different angle, right? Okay. So, where does the fact or the knowledge that I am standing here consist? It is not in any individual one of you, because each of you only has a certain distinct perception, correct? Therefore, the knowledge of the fact that I am standing here exists at once and in the same time in this entire group of people. No individual has that knowledge. You only have a piece of that knowledge, and that knowledge is across all of you, and the fact that I am standing here is created when you talk to each other. That's connectivism. That's the whole theory. And what's really interesting about connectivism is that this is true not just of groups of people like you, but groups of neurons in our head. You have knowledge, you know your own name, right? You all know your own name. Each of you knows it differently, of course, but that knowledge in your head is not in one place, it's not in one neuron, it is distributed across all of the neurons in your head, just like the fact when I'm standing here is distributed across all of you. So now we approach something like generalization, right? It's a theory of knowledge that allows knowledge to be created by networks of connected things. That's all it is. Connected things, connected people, connected neurons. In computer science, we can create artificial neurons and create networks of those. And so in an artificial neural network, which we know today is artificial intelligence, the knowledge or a fact is held not in a single artificial neuron, but in a network. Now, a lot of people will say, with good reason, people do not learn in the same way that computers learn in artificial intelligence. But there are many useful similarities. So we got three kinds of knowledge already, right? You have public knowledge. All of you know the fact that I'm standing here. We have personal knowledge, the neurons in our head. And we have artificial knowledge in artificial intelligence. All created more or less the same way. That's connectivism. So far, so good? Yeah. All right, that's slide one. 80 to go. Okay, so what is knowledge? You can tell I'm a philosopher, right? So knowledge is literally that set of connections. Nothing more, nothing less. Knowledge is the total set of connections in your head. That's your personal knowledge. Knowledge is the total set of connections in society. That's public or social knowledge. If I had a pile of crickets here and they were chirping at each other, there would be cricket knowledge. It's not very much knowledge because they're not very bright, but still. I can tell you had something to say.
Yeah. If you want, I can take your computer up there and they can present your slide.
Okay, but then I'll have to read them off of that. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, go for it. Okay. All right, so while she's doing that, okay. Now, what's really important and a really hard thing for people to get past, and this group might be one of the hardest because you're all involved in language and language learning and language teaching. The properties, according to connectivism, lots of people disagree with me on this, right? But according to connectivism, the properties of knowledge are not the same as the properties of language. Think about that, right? That has to be the case. Because our knowledge, our personal knowledge, is a network of neurons, which does not look like a language at all, Chomsky notwithstanding. So, can you imagine talking about knowledge without using the structure and descriptions of language? It's really hard. imagine talking about knowledge without talking about signs and significance, without talking about representation, without talking about truth and falsehood. Very difficult exercise.
I was hoping the next slide would be here.
Yeah, I have a great memory, but it's short. So, connectivism is thought of as a learning theory. I might be doing these slides out of order, but that's okay. And we need to ask ourselves what a learning theory is. What is it? What is it supposed to do? Now, in the typical description of a theory appeals to generalizations or models in order to make predictions about a specific domain or environment such that what is true in the theory is true in the environment. That's a very traditional conception of a theory. I see it differently though, because I don't really think of theory as a linguistic structure. I think of a theory as a type of knowledge. So it doesn't really do any of those things. There's different ways of thinking about what a theory is. It could be asking you what types of things there are. And we see that in learning theory and in connectivist learning theory. We could be thinking about what the causes of things are. Or we could be thinking about the conditions or the environment that makes things the way they are. None of this is, you know, appealing to general laws or principles. They're often just rough rules of thumbs or guidelines, but that sort of provides the overall picture. And you can't connect to the computer because you don't have a USB 3.
I do have
an adapter. I'll just work from here. I think that'll be easiest. These slides will be available after. All right, let's see how far off I am. Okay. All right. So, I'm thinking about, should I give her the adapter? What do you think? Do you want the slides or not? I'll put it in your hand. Yeah, you'd much rather have the slides, okay. Please say I have my adapter. Good luck. All right. Okay, yeah, those slides were out of order. We'll come back to it as a theory. I'm going to talk a bit more about knowledge. Knowledge in connectivism is what we call, and this is a technical term, emergent. How many of you are familiar with the concept of emergence? Nobody. Okay. On my slide, there's a really neat picture that looks like a dog. And everybody will see that it is a dog. And specifically, it's a Dalmatian. And a Dalmatian is a breed of dog with white fur with black dots. But the picture shows only the black dots, nothing else. So you look at the picture and you ask, what do I see? Well, I see a black dot, 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 right? But when you look at the picture, what you see is a dog. That's emergent. How is that?
No, that's not separate.
Right? How was my description?
It was really close,
yeah. Definitely a Dalmatian. Okay, so what's important isn't the content of the individual dots, it's the organization of the dots. So what that means is, really importantly, the knowledge depends on the perception of the organization. The knowledge is not in the picture. The knowledge is in your head. Now, you're all language teachers. What if I told you the same is true of language? Okay. Oh, I got a clicker. All right, and now we are rolling.
We are a university project that participates in building the social.
You have to click there. That.
Okay. Oh, okay. Let's see, did I go too far? All right, we're back to the boat. Okay. Now, there's a little round, I think it's money. Okay, that is the first time. All right. Now, in connectivism, now, this is just a static picture, right? This picture is never going to learn, ever, right? Because it's static. Remember that. That comes in important later. In connectivism, in a network, all the entities are connected. What do I mean by that? What I mean is, two entities, two things, two people, two neurons, whatever, are connected if and only if, I say it like that because I'm a philosopher, if and only if a change of state in one entity can result in a change of state in another entity. So what that means is the individual entities can influence each other. You talk to your neighbor, and you influence the state of mind of your neighbor. One neuron sends a signal to another neuron, it creates a change of state in that neuron. Make sense? Oh, I didn't even do anything. Oh, you guys are running it. Okay. Oh, is that right? Okay. I should have numbered my slides. Right, okay. Let that be a lesson to you. Always number your slides. Now we're on the next slide. So, okay. You realize what this is doing to my time. This is destroying my time. There we go. All right, so what is learning on this picture? These are all really important concepts, so I don't actually mind taking the time. And if you follow them, then in my opinion, all the rest of my talk will follow anyways. So learning is the creation of this pattern of connected neurons, either in our head or in a society or in a computer. And we create these patterns in different ways. And that's where we get the concept of a learning theory from. Now, if you have studied pedagogy, you've probably studied different things that they call learning theories. Behaviorism, cognitivism, instructivism, constructivism, and even connectivism. None of those are properly learning theories because none of those say exactly how you create connections in a network, right? There we go. This is the slide that I tried to do earlier. So, learning theories telling us about how these connections are created can, as I said, talk about three things. The conditions that support connection or connectivity in a network, the mechanisms that can result in the creation. So by mechanisms, I mean causes and effects. I'm a literalist that way. And then third, less important, but still interesting, describing the kinds of networks that there are. Okay, technology. Oh, and that's Andrea, my wife. So, let me just, before I go on, just, actually, that's the, we've been married since 98, long time. It's the first time she's ever been in one of my slides during a talk. I don't know why. Okay. Are you comfortable with your understanding of connectivism as I've described it?
Yes, sir. Of course.
Right. Do you agree with them? You don't have to, it's okay. In my ideal world, some of you agree with it, some of you don't, some of you would change it, some of you would reject it, some of you are standing in the back saying, he's a heathen! It's all good. It's all good. All right, let's talk about technology. Let's talk about what technology is. I love this. I click the button, the man in the back moves. All right. These days, and probably even in the context of this conference, we think of technology as digital technology, computers and stuff. But technology is a very broad term, really means any sort of collection of tools. And in particular, and this is one definition of technology. I don't completely agree with it, but it was stated recently in a paper, so I thought I'd address that. It can be understood as an orchestration of phenomena for some purpose. Think about everything that's entailed in that particular sentence. Orchestration. Phenomena, not things, but phenomena, experiences, for some purpose, for some goal, for some outcome. That's really interesting. What it means is anything can be a technology as long as you use it to achieve something. That's pretty broad. Let's think about that some more. Teleology is one of those obscure English words. And what it means is, it's a concept that talks about causes in terms of purpose or intent. It used to be the only theory of philosophy we had, the only theory of nature that we had. Aristotle, for example, and I'm gonna caricature a bit, but if I dropped this, it would fall, right? Ask Aristotle, why does it fall? Well, Aristotle's an ancient Greek. He knows nothing about gravity, nothing. All he knows is that things fall. Why does it fall? It falls because it wants to fall. It is in its nature to fall. That's teleology. Teleology is the idea that things have purposes. Everything has purposes. And in our case, and in particular, technology has purposes. So that gives us two choices, right? Either the purpose is inherent in the thing itself, it is the nature of this clicker to fall, or somebody external to the thing assigns it a purpose. Why does it fall? Because I, the holder, want it to fall, so I let go of it and it fell. See, perfectly good explanation of why it fell without any reference to gravity. Philosophy's weird that way. Okay. So I talked about networks earlier. Now I'm going to talk about systems. And in my understanding, and I'm a bit peculiar, but in my understanding, a system is nothing more than a network with a purpose. It's not completely it, but. So what is the purpose of a network? We have a neural network in our head. What is the purpose of that? We have a room full of people, sometimes talking to each other. What is the purpose of that? Interesting. Stafford Beer, one of the founders of systems theory, says the purpose of a system is what it does. And I think that's too limited. For me, I would say the purpose of a system is what it does for us. Purposes are personal, right? That's going to be important later. So what is the purpose of learning technology? And now we get to the core of what the talk is about. We're almost more than halfway done, probably. And what my career has been about, which is definitely more than halfway done. There's three possible answers. Three learning theories. Either to transmit knowledge, to construct knowledge, or to grow knowledge. That might not be the full list, but it will do. So let's look at them. First theory is transmission, to transmit knowledge. It's based on information theory. One of the early proponents in education is Michael G. Moore. You may have heard of him. It's based on a cognitivist idea. And it focuses on the fidelity of transmission. Making sure that the same message that is sent is the message that is received. In education, it's about making sure that the student knows the same thing that the instructor was teaching. It's a theory based on memory, right? But also, its basis on information theory commits it to what we might call a physical symbol system. The idea that we have words in our head. Now, if you agree with connectivism, you know that we do not have words of our inner head. We have experiences that we call words, but they're not words. That's not what a word is, right? A word is something rather more abstract. A word has meaning. Sound doesn't necessarily have meaning. There's a whole argument here, which I don't have time for. Which I would love to give, but I can't. Next theory. Oh, got ahead of me there. The next approach is construction. This is the understanding that knowledge is not transmitted from one person to the next, but is constructed by the receiver anew each time. In educational theory, we call that constructivism. There's a whole body of work around it. You may well be familiar with it. It has its origins in scientific and philosophical constructivism. If you read somebody like, for example, a guy called Bassmann Frassen, who wrote an influential book called The Scientific Image. He talks about constructive empiricism. Or Nelson Goodman, who wrote a book called Ways of World Making. And so the idea is that you give me a bunch of stimuli, maybe involve me in some activities, we do educational stuff, and then I start building models and frameworks and ontologies and all of that stuff in my mind. I'm building them myself. That's why it's really important that everything be hands-on. But those are things that exist in public, like language. And they do not exist in the network itself. We might recognize something as being a word or a model or a structure or an ontology, but they're not actually in the network. They're emergent properties. So the error, in my view, of constructivism is it conflates public knowledge and personal knowledge. It thinks that the things that we build as a society, like models and theories and the rest, are the same as the things that we build in our heads. But they're not. Our heads are much more expressive than that. We build many, many more things. We recognize things that you could never create a model or a theory of. You know, a hint, a smile, shift in the wind. We're super sensitive to all that, even though there's no model or no theory that would ever describe it. So that takes us to growth. Oh, there's a little tiny one up there. I have no hope of reading it. So this is the idea that knowledge develops naturally in each individual learner. This is a hard one, especially for teachers, to wrap their mind around, because getting students to learn is the hardest thing there is to do. And yet, if we were not in the room, students would still be learning. Can't help it. We are learning things. Our brain, I won't say it was designed, but our brain is a thing that learns. That's its only job. Growth is an adaptive response to experience. And we can talk about the whole history of why neurons became the way neurons were. Obviously, no time for that. But basically, we have a neural network, we have experiences. Over time, we adapt to those experiences so that we recognize familiar experiences. That's what learning is. What's really interesting is that in connectivism, unlike the other two philosophies, the purpose of knowledge is separated from the origin of knowledge. There is no inherent reason for our experiences. Our experiences just happen. They don't happen for a reason, they just happen. The reason, the purpose, comes from ourselves. One of the great things about my talks, you can always leave. It's okay. Sorry, I couldn't resist. All right, gotta move on a little faster here. I don't know what the time is, so. Because there's no clock. You're in this room. You're not supposed to be aware of the passage of time. You're supposed to pay attention to the speaker. No. Interesting, this sense. There's a whole architecture of control of design. Dan Lockhart writes about this fascinating field. All right, diversity. Difference rather than sameness. Diversity, I mean, it's almost a loaded term these days, but I think it's a great word. I love it. I'll use this definition from UNESCO. References practices that create equitable and supportive learning environments that, importantly, respect, value, and respond to the differences among learners, regardless of background, identity, or ability. Sound right to you? Does that sound right? You can say yes, you can say no, it's okay. Diversity, remember? You don't all have to agree. Okay. Included in the concept of diversity is often equity and inclusion. And in the case of diversity, remember the slogan was difference, not the same. Here, it's all but not some. See the distinction, right? They're two different concepts. Inclusion is about including everybody. Diversity is about everybody being different. Two distinct concepts, very important. So typically the argument is, and I don't really disagree with it, supporting diversity by promoting more equitable and inclusive education systems. Yeah, if you want to support diversity, you make sure education is available for all. So, I'm not Ecuadorian and nothing like an expert in the Ecuadorian context, but my understanding of the Ecuadorian context is that diversity is understood as multinational, multicultural, and inclusive. Something that aligns with the state of affairs in Ecuador, which has diverse geographic, cultural, and linguistic communities, and emphasizes the rights of these communities, peoples, and nationalities. That was fast. It's also based on the idea of human rights, and here we get into equity and inclusion more. But interestingly, I just pulled this out of a very long document. This approach centers on the human being, both in their individual and social dimension. Remember, I was talking about social knowledge, personal knowledge, individual dimension, social dimension. They're both important. Education is a right that enables the development of other rights. Long story there, we can talk about that, but won't. To achieve a dignified life. There's a lot of work being done by that phrase. Because, just to forecast what's coming, each of us has a different idea of what counts as a dignified life, right? What's dignified to you is very undignified to me, and vice versa. All right. Oh, moved before I clicked it. All right. There are different ways of casting these objectives. One is to promote the capital. So there are different ways of talking about the purpose of diversity. One of them is to achieve social and economic objectives in a country. Economic development, training of individuals to be individuals, to launch their own initiatives, to support, as they say, an entrepreneurial spirit. Again, a long conversation could be had. Oh, we missed a slide. Back up and back up again. Another reason for supporting diversity is the human rights approach, right? Diversity ensures human rights. Engagement of diversity, support for diversity ensures human rights. Okay, go ahead, too. But why? The need for diversity does not follow from either of these. Okay? We may agree that the economy should be more productive, and diversity produces that. We may agree that human rights are important, and diversity produces that. But those themselves are not sufficient to argue for diversity in a society. And we can see that in other societies around the world where they agree with both of these things, but they do not like diversity. There needs to be a better, more concrete, more pragmatic, more practical reason for supporting diversity. Guess what's on the next slide? Oh, back up. Okay, go ahead, forward. I talked earlier about the conditions for learning. Right? What are the conditions that produce success in a network? What are the conditions that make knowledge possible in a network? I describe this as the semantic condition. There's a reason for that. It has to do with meaning, value, truth. This is the part that allows our network to support things like meaning, value, and truth. And diversity is one of those conditions. Why is diversity necessary? Because in a network, if you do not have diversity, you do not have any communication between network because everything is the same. Remember the picture of a dog that I showed? That picture will never learn because none of the dots can change any of the other dots. They're all the same. They're all black round dots and they don't move. The only way to learn is for the entities, the objects, the people in a network to be different. So they have something to say to each other. That's a general law of physics. I don't know if it's ever been expressed quite that way, but I mean, how do you produce electricity? Well, the voltage here is different from the voltage here, and that's what creates the flow. How do you get plumbing? The water pressure here is greater than the water pressure here, and that's how you move water. How do you create ideas? The opinion of this person here is different from the opinion of this person here, and so content flows. And the network reshapes, and it becomes more responsive. It learns. Diversity is necessary for learning. So, we could talk, and I won't talk long about this, about the varieties of diversity. People often focus on diversity in terms of what people are, what culture they are, what gender they are, what background they are, what linguistic community they are, etc. But there are many more ways of being diverse. We can think of each person as having their own experiences, creating diversity of experiences. We can talk about diversity of purposes and goals, and this is really important in education because we assume everybody has the same purpose, but they don't. I'm looking at all of you right now. Some of you are really engaged in what I'm saying. Thank you. Some of you can barely stay awake. It's okay. Some of you left, right? I understand that each one of you is here for a different reason. Oh yeah, sure, there's some overlap, right? Some of the people are here because they have to be. They're getting paid to be, right? Others are other speakers, the organizers, there's all of you, your own different experiences and needs. All of that is diversity. And as well, there's personal diversity, which we never really talk about, but to me is critical and fundamental to learning. Think about it. If you woke up every day and sat in the same room with gray walls that never changed, you probably would not learn very much. You would still learn because you're a human. And in fact, your mind would start putting patterns on that gray wall because it's desperate to learn. But really, what supports learning, personal learning, is diversity of experience. So this engages and requires the other conditions for a learning network. Openness, being open to new experiences, new points of view, new ways of living your life, new animals and birds and tastes, etc. And autonomy, having agency, following your own interests, your own purposes, doing what you think is important rather than what other people think is important. This too adds to that diversity. And it involves me getting email, it looks like. Thank you. It involves understanding that social knowledge isn't broadcast from me to you, where you remember what I said and agree with it. Rather, it involves us talking with each other and then the knowledge emerging from our many different diverse perspectives. If I understand that as a person, then it becomes much less important for me to convince you that I'm right. In fact, my purpose and intent changes entirely. It doesn't matter nearly as much if you agree with me. My purpose and intent is to be as clear as possible in my communication, partly so that I understand it and partly so that you understand it. And then you do with it what you will. Maybe you agree, maybe you don't agree, maybe you tell me it's time's up and it's, anyhow. They're being very nice to me. Maybe too nice. All right. The human connection. This is what I've been working on for the last few years. Okay. So, what has really interested me over the last few years is, how do we make all of this work as a community? And especially as learning communities. And historically, what we've done is we've built platforms and then everybody goes to the platform. We've built a big university, everybody goes to the university, and online, we build a learning management system and everybody goes to the learning management system. Everybody's in the same place. You already know what I think about that. These days, with artificial intelligence, the way people out there are developing learning technology, they're just adding AI to the platform, which is probably the least imaginative use of AI that you can come up with. But what we're not doing is allowing learners to define their own learning environment. We have all kinds of reasons for it, right? They're not capable. They don't know what they want. We understand pedagogy and they don't, etc. But if we want to foster diversity of purpose, diversity of learning, then having them develop their own learning environment is the way to go, and that's what I've been working on. What does that look like? It's not easy. So, what we see typically in a platform is something called personalization, right? This is the idea that everybody uses the same learning platform, but the platform learns about you and then adapts. Sometimes called adaptive learning, sometimes called personalized learning. Loved by the technology community because they can sell one big piece of enterprise software for millions of dollars instead of a whole bunch of individual pieces of software. The vendor still defines what the learning pathways are and what the learning outcomes are. No matter what the purpose of the learner is, the learning outcome has been defined by the teacher, which to me seems exactly wrong. The platform, that could include the university, and it these days includes technology companies, owns and controls all the data. You don't own your own learning. Think about that. The AI makes recommendations. The dominant value is optimization. This is an instructivist approach. It's the learning as transmission approach. It's just we're modulating the transmission and using feedback mechanisms, which today we call surveillance. Slide. I didn't even, full of the system, I didn't click. More progressive learning technology focuses on collaboration. I think that is an improvement, for sure. Where the system, instead of creating learning, learning objects, whatever, creates communities. Socially defined pathways of learning. Maybe learning contracts, maybe collaborative learning. The platform still owns and controls the data because it's a platform. The AI participates as a collaborator. The technical term these days is called human autonomy teaming. And it's based in process. It's a constructivist approach, but we're still locked into sameness. In instructivism, sameness is based on the teacher. In constructivism, sameness is based on the community. But we're still being drawn into being the same. Coming up with a common language. Working toward a shared vision. Does that sound familiar? Should. I don't agree with that either. You knew that was coming. I support, because it's a connectivist approach, but also because it's the right approach, personal learning. That's what I call it. The learner shapes the system. And I mean literally builds their own technological environment. You can do that now with artificial intelligence. The learner defines the architecture. Can you imagine that? Imagine we had a university here, but there was no administration and no instructors, but you still had all of these students with all of the resources that were previously available to the university. And now each individual learner could shape their own learning, however they wanted. That's how universities actually and literally used to work a long time ago. We had talked about that for a long time too. AI, the learner owns and controls the data. You own your own data. That's a big mouthful right there. The AI and other technology are directed. Remember, technology is a network with a purpose. You, the learner, or me, I, the learner, define that purpose. And based on that purpose, I direct the technology. So that my learning outcomes are the things that I actually wanted to achieve by learning. Interesting. If you could choose whatever it is as an outcome of your learning, would you still be in this room? I find that a fascinating question. Keeps me humble. This is a connectivist approach, and it's based on diversity and autonomy. A lot of talk about agency these days, mostly about artificial intelligence agents, but agency is crucial to personal learning. And I argue technology should be an architecture of agency. I could have said a system of agency. I could have said networks of agency. I mean the same thing. Where people choose and connect their own tools, their own sources, define their own identity, pick their own place to store stuff, to publish stuff if they want to publish stuff, choose the people with whom they collaborate or cooperate. No more forced groups. Agency and an architecture of agency helps us overcome the many barriers to inclusion and diversity that we have faced in the past. It's not just about tolerating and understanding people who are different from you. It's about putting the tools in their hands and your hands so that they can express that difference as much as possible, or as little as possible, whatever they want to do. Some would call that a radical vision, but I call that common sense. How does it work? I sometimes talk about the syntax and the semantics of a system. Remember I talked about the semantic condition? Meaning, truth, value. Those are personally defined. And they're defined by a network, by a community, right? They're not defined by the technology. They're defined by the people using the technology. The distinction here is the syntactic component, how the pieces fit together. In order to promote semantic diversity, you need syntactic openness. You need mechanisms for the message to travel from one person to another person. It should be possible for different learners to build different environments, but still be able to talk to each other. So the job of a technology of agency is to provide that syntax. You know, it's like a road. We've all, well, maybe not all of us, but I was in a car driving earlier. Well, I wasn't driving, someone else was driving, because you do not want me driving on Ecuadorian streets. And yet you're driving, there's all kinds of other people driving around you. Nobody cares why you're on the road. Nobody cares where you're going, what your objective is, right? They really care a lot that they stay on their side of the road and you stay on your side of the road, right? Semantics, syntax. That's it. I know, you want a nice concluding remark. All right. Here's they're being so kind to me and not chasing me off the stage, and I don't want to abuse that privilege, and I understand that it's a privilege. I think that this approach is an approach that is positive, not just for learning and not just for learning technology, but as a way of living and as a way of building a society. And like all things in education, it begins not with the classroom, not with the textbook, not with the instruction, but with ourselves. And the way to foster diversity, inclusion, openness, learning in general, good societies, roads where people stay on the right side of the road, is to instantiate these in ourselves. To ourselves be open. To ourselves embrace diversity. To ourselves be personally autonomous, to express agency, and to ourselves understand that we don't need to convince other people to be like us. We just want to celebrate and appreciate them for who they are. And every time I look at a group of people, right, it's easy to lose the individuals in the network, but each individual actually has a life, actually has hopes and dreams, actually wants things, actually doesn't want some things, actually wants to be out of this room, or actually wants this to continue. And understanding that is understanding that each person, not just in an abstract philosophical way, but in a concrete way that you can sense, each person is undeniably important. And we should structure our society and our systems of learning around that understanding. If we do that, if we do that first in ourselves and then in the communities we build, that is the best way to create learning. And that's the concluding message I forgot to put on the slide.
Dear Stephen.
Hola.
Dear Stephen, we extend our most sincere thanks to you for outstanding participation in this convention. Your valuable perspective and world-class expertise have provided us with profound insight into the evolution of modern education. Having your vision and presence with us from Canada has been an absolute privilege and an invaluable contribution to our professional community. Now, we will open the floor for questions from the audience.
Her hand went straight up, so okay. I don't want to recognize okay. that.
Impacting student critical thinking development.
Sorry. No, I got it. How can we implement this without impacting critical thinking development? Does that sound right? Yeah. My first job in education was as a logic teacher, and the course I taught was critical thinking. So, critical thinking is important. I think of critical thinking as a type of pattern recognition. And I actually define six different types of pattern recognition. Semantics and syntax, which I talked about today. Pragmatics, or context. Pragmatism, or use. Cognition, which includes deduction, induction, definition, and description, and that's the core of critical thinking, and then change. Change is different from all the rest. So each of those is a different way of recognizing patterns. And when I teach critical thinking, I haven't taught it for a little while, but when I did, what I would try to get students to do is to be able to recognize errors in learning. And I would teach them, what are the signs? Right? So, for example, a classic error of reasoning is called the slippery slope, where you say, well, if this happens, then that happens, then that'll happen, then that'll happen, then that'll happen, and then society collapses. That's critical. That's slippery slope. You can recognize a possible case of slippery slope by seeing that the person has said, if this happens, that's the sign, right? And then you apply the test. So critical thinking is pattern recognition, and it's a type of pattern recognition that helps us avoid errors. And that's how you maintain critical thinking.
The next question is the girl with the sweater ring. Yes, you.
Oh, that's not who I meant.
Do you think connectivism can support all types of learning, or are there subjects where traditional methods were better?
I'm sorry, I didn't. Did you understand?
Can you repeat, please?
Do you think connectivism can support types or learning, or are there subjects where traditional methods were better?
Yeah. Are there subjects where traditional methods of learning work better? The answer that you'll see in the literature is that the more structured, more formal approaches work better with younger ages. That's what you'll see in the literature. I don't really agree with that. I do agree that with young people, we have to prevent them from hurting themselves because they're not very smart. But I still think that fostering an environment of agency and personal liberty, self-determination and all of that, connectedness, etc., I think that that's preferable. Even with young children. And I think that this also applies across disciplines. We could look at any discipline you care to look at. The six types of patterns that I just referenced, we can take everything in that discipline, represented in each of those six types of disciplines, understand the patterns that people are trying to experience in order to learn that discipline, and then see how to apply a connectivist approach to that. The next person to ask a question will be the woman sitting next to the man in the blue and white checkers, because she's tried so hard and we keep missing her.
My question is how connectivism can be used to improve language learning and communicative skills.
So I hardly need to repeat that one, but I will. How connectivism can be used to improve language learning and communicative skills. Now, as a Canadian, I have been a victim of language learning. Think about that. Alors maintenant, je peux parler en français. I spent 12 years in school trying to learn French and failed. Literally just did not succeed. And it wasn't until I put myself into an immersive, communicative environment. It also involved trying to comprehend the patterns of the language. And the patterns of the language aren't just the grammar and syntax, you know this. The patterns of the language are how the language feels, how the language rolls, what seems right. And that's, we would call that an intuition, but that's still learning the language, right? French, like Spanish, has gender. You know how awful gender is, gendered nouns are for an English speaker? Horrible, horrible, Eventually, I got to the point where I can correctly assign gender to a noun, not based on any rules or principles, but on just what feels right. Right. Now, how did I get to that point? It wasn't through any sort of traditional instruction. It was through immersing myself in the language, reading in it, talking in it, using it. You know, I'm building technology right in front of the big opening screen, it says, people talk to people. And that's the basis for personal learning. That's the basis, I think, of language learning. You can later on formalize it, but I think that's a later on thing. Just like in English, right? Most people who speak English do not know English grammar.
It's our pleasure to give you a present, to thank you for your contribution to the Phi English Convention. Please welcome Master Jorge Zambrano, professor of this career.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you so much for being here. We appreciate a lot. This is a gift for us.
Oh, it's a bag.
Yeah,
it's a bag
for you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Tira. You can have a seat.
Thank you so much.
Right. Now get off the stage.
Okay.